Dog Works Radio Network presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Everybody, this is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio here on KVRF 89.7 in the Matsu Valley. RadioFreePalmer.org is our live streaming site, and you can find all of our episodes over on Apple Podcasts. Just search for Dog Works Radio. We're also all over social media under that same name. Check us out there. And if you'd like, do us a comment or review over on iTunes. It would be greatly appreciated. And calling in from Southern California is Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. It's sort of we're in the middle of the hot part of summer here in Southern California. It never gets all that hot, but we've been up in the 90s. The past couple weeks. Luckily, not as much humidity as you get back east, but that's a little bit warm for me.
Talking about warm, I was just down in the Bay Area this past weekend, and it was 100, 102 degrees on Saturday and in the high 90s on Sunday. And for a guy coming from Alaska, where today it is 57 degrees, it's quite warm down there.
Right, and you know, even in Alaska, we should point out that it does get, you know, warm or warmish in the summer. But we always see, you know, my Alaskan friends are always posting things about how in the winter or in the spring, when it gets to be like 20 or 30 degrees, they'll go out in shorts and flip flops. So, That's a pretty good amount of heat for someone from Alaska.
And you know, one other point on that, I was at a theme park there near San Jose, and there were folks there in that kind of heat. I'm not talking about one or two. I'm talking about all kinds of folks that were wearing jackets and beanie caps, and I don't know if that's a style of Central Northern California or they just don't know how to deal well with that overwhelming heat. Who in the world would wear a beanie cap at 100 degrees?
Well, you know, I agree with you. I've seen a lot of that here in Los Angeles as well. People wearing wool caps when it's 80, 90, or 95 degrees, which seems insane to me. I think we should, you know, we should keep our wool caps for when it gets down below freezing.
Right, right. So it is midsummer here, like they have in baseball, sort of that seventh inning stretch in the middle of the season where not a lot's happening. Do you have any mushing news for us? I know it's kind of been a slow news month in terms of, postings and things of what's happening in this neck of the woods.
Yeah, you know, we've had a bunch of people signing up a couple weeks ago and signing up at or around the picnic. I haven't seen any additional signups in the past couple weeks. They usually take a while to trickle in the initial batch, but Iditarod.com hasn't really updated it. We're still at 57, which you know is a great number for the middle of July, but I'm expecting, you know, I may as well go out on a limb because all of my predictions are wrong, as longtime listeners know. But I am expecting at this point that we will have next March a field of 83 teams running Iditarod.
Well, that's sort of an odd number to pick, 83, but I guess there has to be a number somewhere. But it sounds like a great number to me, as it has been in the last several years, anywhere between 70 and 85 or so mushers in the last decade or so. So that's a pretty safe bet on your part. I don't think you're really a gambling man, are you, Alex? I don't see too often on Facebook that you're hanging out in Vegas.
Not so much, although a friend of mine did teach me his system for playing craps, which the one time that I used it, I won $200 very quickly and then decided I would retire forever from my gambling days.
Very good. All right. The only real news I saw, Alex, over the last week or so was something that was posted over on the Wild and Free page that is operated by Brent Sass. He mentioned on his Facebook page that he is not going to run the Iditarod or the Yukon Quest. He says he has some personal things that he would like to do, some, you know, things other than mushing, which is, you know, very commendable. You got to have a life outside of, you know, outside of the dream, so to speak. But he is going to concentrate on the K300, the highest purse race in Alaska and in mid-distance sports. Did you get a chance to see that post?
Yeah, I just saw that I think this morning. You know, and it's certainly we've talked a lot about the expenses that go into running a race like the Iditarod or the Yukon Quest. It certainly is something that requires a tremendous amount of focus and time and energy. And you know, as great as Brent Sass is, and as wonderful a competitor as he is, I think sometimes for some of these guys, it might actually do them good to take a year off and sort of regroup and refocus a little bit.
Right. And not saying this is how it's happening over at Brent's kennel. This is pure speculation on that part. But, you know, we've talked a lot about it on this show, sort of that five-year cycle where, you know, dogs come up as puppies and they, you know, run on the puppy team or the B team. Then they do very well for 3 or 4 years in Iditarod and they have that real peak. And then it takes time to build up that kennel again and bring those puppies back in and you know, sort of start over and sort of, you know, do very well with that next batch of dogs. Now, there are plenty of mushers out there that have puppies all the time, and they're constantly grooming up those puppy teams or those B teams, and they're having handlers run, you know, the non-race team, so to speak. So they sort of have that cycle going all the time. But for most kennels, there is that peak time of about 5 years. And, you know, when we did our decade show where we talked about all of the winners over the decades, you would really notice those peaks and valleys of folks. You know, when Doug Swingley was hot, when Lance Mackey was hot, now Mitch and Dallas Sevier right there. You see those 4 or 5 year peaks there, and you know, you really see what's happening in that cycle. Do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, it's both unusual and very inspiring when someone will have a particular very, very strong peak cycle and then be able to come back and do very well or win significant races after that peak cycle when they're building towards another peak cycle. And I know that, for example, Jeff King had a period where he was just very, very dominant and then kind of dropped off and fell back and seems to have had a couple of years where he was just on the verge of reestablishing himself as, you know, the premier or one of the premier teams out there. So it's interesting that someone can have that great mushers can have that one peak cycle and really take advantage of it. But the really amazing dog men and women are the ones who can have that peak cycle, ride it, and then be able to come back and build to another one.
Right, right. So, Alex, before we jump into our main topic today, I have a question for you. I know we've talked about this before, but I'm interested to hear what you have to say because I think you do much more following than I do. I just sort of catch it in bits and pieces. But can you tell us your top 4 or 5 places where you go on social media to follow kennels? What pages do you find the most entertaining, the most informative? Who do you really like to follow out there? Because, you know, some people put great information and some of them are very sporadic, and you may see something during the start of Iditarod, and you might not see anything else for the rest of the year.
Yeah, well, there is just an enormous amount of stuff on Facebook these days. So I go to the Iditarod Trail Committee page, which has a lot of really great stuff there. That's obviously much more official stuff, so you don't tend to see things that are as controversial as some groups talk about. So I like that. There's a lot of individual kennels that I follow. And off of Facebook, I really like the Allie Zirkel, her kennel, the SPC kennel, has a lot of really great informative stuff on there. And there are a couple of other Iditarod groups on Facebook that I follow. Some of them are public, some of them are private groups or secret groups, but it's mostly groups of fans who post about things dealing with the Iditarod or with individual kennels. So I think that's where I get a lot of my information, and then I am at least in the off season, at least once a week, I'll just search on Twitter for mentions of Iditarod or the hashtag Iditarod, and then I have a Google alert for Iditarod and dog mushing, so I get stuff sent to me from that.
You know, all great great ideas for sure. I follow all those same groups. Do the fan pages in particular, do they post a lot of stuff on the off season, you think, or is it sort of slow these days?
It's mostly slow these days. There are some of these pages have evolved over time to be much more social things about the members. And so during the off season, there's a lot of stuff about where people are going on their vacations, which is fine. It's not something that I'm as interested in because, unless it's someone that I know or I've had contact with, I'm not really that interested in where they're going on vacation unless it's someplace really cool that I want to go. But yeah, it definitely slows down in the off season. It tends to start picking up again in the fall when people go back to training, and then is usually these pages are very, very active during the racing season.
One other piece of news I forgot to mention when we were talking back about that, if we can backtrack a little bit. I know we've talked quite a bit last month or so about some of the major sponsors pulling out of the Iditarod, and we talked about one in particular, Wells Fargo Bank. And just in the last couple of weeks or so, another banking partner affiliated themselves with the Iditarod and became a major sponsor, and it is North Rim Bank, and they are a local bank here in Alaska. They're not one of the big conglomerates like Chase Bank or Wells Fargo or Citibank or something like that. Did you see that, and do you have any thoughts on, a smaller Alaskan-type business taking up the slack from the big boys that let go?
I think it's a great thing, and I'm definitely all in favor of that. And one of the things that happened when a big national sponsor pulls out is a lot of people start talking about, well, they don't understand Alaska and they don't understand how important Iditarod is to Alaskans. So from that point of view, I think anytime a local sponsor can come in and can really step up in a big way, that's going to buy them an enormous amount of goodwill from Alaskans and also from Iditarod fans. So, it's always a danger that a more national brand or a more national company would be subject to this kind of, you know, selective pressure put on it about sponsoring the Iditarod. And I think that Alaskan companies are just not as susceptible to that. So
right.
I think it's a really wonderful thing.
It is my opinion. They understand what the Iditarod is about. They understand the culture of the Iditarod in Alaska. You know, my thoughts on that, because I read in the press release and in some of the information about that sponsorship, they said that they were also going to do some banking business with this bank. And for folks that aren't aware of how banks work in terms of one item, like credit card processing, they charge anywhere from 2 to 5% on every charge that goes through. I can see that as a real win-win for that local bank if they became sort of the credit card processor or the money handlers of the Iditarod. Just imagine all of that business that that little bank could receive just by receiving that small percentage of funds that would be funneled through that bank by using the relationship with the Iditarod.
Yeah, and you know, there's a lot more to banking than what we usually think of, which is, you know, you deposit money in there and you write checks or you get a loan for your car or for your house or something. But there's just a lot more that goes into modern banking. And like you said, if they can capture that little bit, you know, those 2 to 5% of all the charges, you know, if we just think about how many people subscribe to the Iditarod Insider, for example, and if you get 2% of each one of those subscriptions, that's an enormous amount of money.
Right, and if it is a local bank, I guess those funds would stay in the local community, which would be a real nice thing, you know, in compared to some of those major sponsors where we don't see a lot of those local funds coming in where they have, you know, the headquarters all over the country, not just up here as well. All right, Alex, anything else before we jump into today's topic? I know we spent quite a bit of time on our updates. I wasn't anticipating that, but that's okay by me.
No, let's just dive in.
All right, let's dive in. You know, a couple of weeks ago, guys, we talked about one of the Mushing legends. We talked about Doc Lombard. And today we're going to follow that up with Charlie Bedford. He was known as Sonny, and he was sort of on the heels of Doc Lombard in the mid to late 30s. And he used to race back then in the day. Siberians were just coming popular, as we know the story of Leonard Septila and you know, the, you know, sort of the advent of the Siberian Husky making its way east from Alaska. Charlie, or Sonny as he was called, used to run Coonhounds, which is sort of ironic because that's what a lot of folks are running today, some type of hound dog in a lot of these sprint races. But he raced up in Laconia, New Hampshire, which was the hotbed of mushing in New England, and he met up with Sepala, and he was one of the first folks to get a Sepala Siberian, which is sort of the basis of the modern Siberian Husky and what most people know them as of today. And in 1937, at just 17 years old, he had his sights set on becoming a veterinarian. So he sort of put his mushing on the back burner while he did his studies and became a veterinarian. And then right during World War II, he opened up his vet practice and decided at that point he was going to put as much effort as he possibly could into being a top world-class musher. And he did so. He began running many races and doing very well. As I mentioned, he ran up in the Laconia races in the early 40s, and he really began winning up there in New England, often in a field where he was the only American, which I think is pretty interesting. By the early 1950s, his Siberians, which he sort of nurtured in the last decade or so, were running at about 12 to 13 miles an hour, which is quite fast compared to how a typical Siberian runs in mushing races today. They often call them Slowburians, I believe is how they pronounce it, meaning they're just more of sort of a trotter down the trail, and they are real comfortable going long distances at relatively slow speed, you know, 7, 8, 9 miles an hour. But Sonny was very deliberate in his technique of breeding, and he bred this fast. These fast traits, you know, through generation over generation of Siberian, and he became pretty good at these races with a team of Siberians, which is what sort of piqued the interest all over not only New England but of course North America during that time. And then as things progressed, he became known as one that was a real dog man. I know you had mentioned earlier in the show, Alex, about these true dog men, true dog women, who sort of had that knack of just, you know, having their way with dogs. And he and Sonny Belford was one of them. He has been quoted of saying as he could walk into a dog yard and pick out the best dog, and that would be the one. That would be the one that the musher thought was doing his best. Charlie Belford returned to racing in 1956, where he won his first world championship there at Laconia and several other New England races, including two at Lake Placid and big races in Quebec. And he then beat out his mentor there, Doc Lombard, in 1960, and sort of made his own name to the legacy. So I guess sort of the moral to this story, Alex, is we talked about that 5-year cycle earlier in the show about how it takes a time to sort of build up and sort of unleash the monster, as Dallas calls it. But if you read the story of Charlie, it took him a couple of decades before he really became good and was winning the big races and, you know, doing things that really put his name on the map. So I guess that's sort of my take from it. What are your thoughts on Charlie, and what did I skip over?
Well, you know, he had a very good long racing career, and he was, you know, he was someone who I think it's fair to say he started a little bit slowly and then built up to where he was very, very successful, you know, in the mid 60s. And he, as you said, he was someone who was really renowned for his ability to pick great dogs. And there was a time in the 60s and 70s where dogs from his bloodline were considered really, really prized racing dogs. He's not as well known these days as a lot of the more famous dog racers of that time, but he was always someone who would just be out there and having great dogs. And the other thing that I wanted to mention about him is every picture I've seen of him behind a dog team, he looks like he is just having the time of his life. And you know, we've seen a lot of these sort of old time dog men or dog women who it seems to be a much more serious thing for him. And I'm not saying for them, I'm not saying it wasn't serious for him, but he also seemed to enjoy it just so much. And if you look at the pictures of him with various dog teams, his dogs look like they are just having the time of their lives as well.
Yeah, I agree. When you mentioned that, I was thinking about the pictures I'd seen of him in the past. And, you know, earlier in the show, we were talking about Brent Sass, and he has that same look, doesn't he? It's not that serious, you know, thousand-mile stare that you see a lot of these mushers having in photos or, you know, in their interviews. But he has that happy-go-lucky smile. He seems like he is, you know, just ready to go out there and take on the world, and it just has that resemblance of of Charlie Belford way back in the day.
Yeah, and you know the other thing about Charlie, and he passed away, I guess, about 12 years ago, in 2005, and I never had the privilege of either talking to him or hearing many interviews with him, but apparently from what everyone said around the time of his death, he was someone who just loved talking dogs. So even when he was, you know, when he was in the latter part of his life and was, you know, in his 80s and was sick, he would get on the phone with people and they would start talking dogs and he would just become energized and someone would think that they were going to have a 10 or 15 minute conversation with him and they would be on the phone for like 2 hours. So, you know, one common thing that we find with a lot of these people is that once you get talking dogs, they light up and they can go on seemingly forever talking to you about dogs and dog care and their favorite trail stories and all of that.
Right. And that was well before the day of Facebook where, you know, you can just sort of, you know, make a post and comment it at leisure. It was a big deal to sort of sit around and talk to these legends about, you know, what's kind of spinning around in their head. What knowledge can they impart on either the, you know, the younger mushers in the field or, you know, just folks that are willing to hear the stories.
Yeah, and you know there are one of the things about the Iditarod and also Alaska in general is these are both relatively Alaska is a young state and the Iditarod is a relatively young event. So the people who were there at the beginning, not all of them, but some of them are still around, and that's true both of the founding of the state of Alaska and of people who were there at the very early years of Iditarod. So, it's still possible and will be possible for the next, you know, few years to really get a lot of that firsthand knowledge and firsthand experiences that people had. And that's a rare thing with events like this.
Right. Alex, we're just about out of time. I have a show suggestion for next time. Maybe you can take the lead on that one since I did Charlie and Doc. Let's talk about Norman Vaughn. How is that?
Oh, I love Norman Vaughn. That sounds wonderful. Yes.
All right, guys. So in just a couple of weeks, we'll be back on the air, and Alex will tell you a story or two about one of the coolest mushing men that I have ever read about, Colonel Norman Vaughn. So we're looking forward to hearing that story. And again, if you guys have comments, questions, whatever, you have show ideas here in the off season, just shoot us a line on Facebook, on Twitter, whichever, and we will definitely take that under consideration. Alex, it's been a pleasure as always, and we'll talk again soon, okay?
Okay, thanks, Robert.
Thank you. On behalf of my co-host, Alex Stein, this is Robert Forto for Mushing Radio. We'll see you guys next time.